Well, tomorrow is the big day for the Pittsburgh Marathon. This year, Foundation Outreach International is officially represented in the marathon by about a dozen members of our congregations, and we'll be running for the foundation. And we have had an opportunity, and still do, to make a pledge, to make a donation in the name of one or more of the runners. The donations benefit the Foundation Outreach International Scholarship Program, which provides opportunity for COGWA members in developing nations to acquire a college-level education and training. Now, nations such as those, we call them developing nations, education is especially practical and important for our young members. The cost of higher education for them is relatively inexpensive compared to our cost and here in the U.S., but it's still beyond the means of many of our members. Now, Foundation Outreach for this particular event has not yet reached their financial goal, but there's still time to make a donation, and I do hope that you would be willing to consider to do so. The information is on this card. Do we have any other more copies of this, Everett? Good. I'll ask Everett maybe to put one or two at the information table, because the website, unless you know how to scan the little barcode there, the website is very obscure, and if I read it to you, you're going to say, what? So I'll let you look it up on the card. You can go to the website. It gives you very clear directions for how you can make a donation if you would like to do that. And certainly, as was mentioned in the announcement, very much appreciated. The marathon here in Pittsburgh is a pretty big deal. As far as compared to other marathons, it's probably not that much, but I've heard different estimates. One number I heard last night, I really have trouble believing it's true, up to 40,000 runners in all the different events, I suppose, not just the marathon, but it's a whole weekend long, a whole bunch of different relays and shorter races and children's races and puppy races and all these things. So thousands of people are going to be involved, and a couple of 100,000 or more will be here just to observe and to see the action and to support those who will be doing the running. When I was younger, I really enjoyed running. I transferred to a new high school in my sophomore year. And when you go to a new school, you're always the kid everybody looks down on, picks on, doesn't really care to be around. Well, on this first day of school, we had a physical fitness test. And part of the fitness test was a mile run. So some of the guys, the ones who were on the teams, the runners and the people that were popular, were having a little bit of fun with me because I'm just this new, funny-looking, skinny kid, and I'm there to take this mile-run test with them. So I tried not to let it bother me much, but when we got started, I thought, well, I'm not going to try to make any big deal of this. I'll just run my race, run the way that I run. So I finished the mile in about 5.5 minutes, well ahead of most of those kids who were on my case before we started. The teacher, the PE instructor, encouraged me to go out for the cross-country team or for the track team, but I didn't really have much confidence, didn't really care to be around all these pleasant fellows, and so I never really took advantage of that. But over the years, jogging became a part of my life, and it was the way that I dealt with stress. For years, I had a job that was, I felt, very stressful, and I would come home from work, spend a little time with the family, and then I'd go out and run just to try to relax and work off some of that anxious energy that I felt. Wherever we lived, I'd map out a route about 5 miles or so, and that was what I would run 3 or 4 times a week. In fact, for several years, we lived in Beaverton, Oregon. And one of my hidden pleasures, a carnal pleasure that I had, was to lace up my Adidas, and then go on the jogging path that ran right in front of the world headquarters of the Nike Corporation. And I always wished that there'd be some executive up there on one of the upper levels looking down and seeing me in my Adidas running past his building. But I'm sure that never happened. But I got a kick out of it, whether anybody else ever noticed or not. So looking back, frankly, I wish that I had taken advantage and taken running a little more seriously. But at that time, participating in a half or a full marathon was just simply not on my radar. Of course, now those days are long gone. Now, running is a part of life, and it's actually something that we're all familiar with the idea or the concept that running is a metaphor for life, and it's a metaphor that's embedded in Scripture. Running can teach us some very simple and basic and important lessons, some clear principles that we can apply as we compare it to the activity of just going out for a jog or a run. The title of the sermon today is Run for Your Life. We all know what running is. Running is to move at a pace that's faster than a walk. Our little grandson, when he was about 2 years of age, was learning how to run. And we'd say, "Run, Nolan, run." And so he'd put his head down and put his arms like this and walk. But he thought he was running if he was doing this. And it didn't take him long to catch on. But one easy way to identify whether or not we're running, a definition for running is that we never have both feet on the ground at the same time. If you have both feet on the ground at the same time, I guess no matter how fast you're moving, you're not running. Running, of course, is that moving at an accelerated pace, and typically we have a purpose or a destination in mind. People don't generally randomly just run. If they are moving that quickly, it's because they have someplace they want to go, they have a destination, they have a purpose. And of course, there are different paces for running. Sometimes we sprint. Sometimes we run more at a jog or move at a pace that just slightly has 1 foot off the ground. But the implication is that you're going somewhere. You're not just aimlessly ambling around. The Bible has some things to say about running that can be helpful to us and help us to learn lessons. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 18, verse 10. Proverbs chapter 18. Verse 10. It says, "The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe." To run to the tower of the Lord means, of course, that we look to Him for our security and our safety. But to run in that direction implies that it's an important thing. We have a sense of urgency, and we go to God for what He can provide for us. He provides for us safety and security. The word translated safe in this verse literally means to be set on high or to be lifted up. In other words, again, to be protected and secure, to be put in a place under God's care and under His protection. God is the one we look to. We run to Him not just when we're in danger or in need, but we run to Him because He is that source of security and safety in our lives. We run to Him by the way that we live, by our relationship with Him in prayer and in the study of His Word, the basics of life. We run to Him for that security and safety. Consider also Psalm 119. Psalm 119, verse 32. Psalm 119, verse 32. It says, I will run the course of your commandments, for you shall enlarge my heart. Running the path of God's commandments means, of course, again, to commit ourselves to the way that those commandments show us to live. It indicates a level of purpose and energy. Obeying God is not something that we just casually do, but it's that we do with energy and with purpose and with a desire to receive from Him the safety and security we read of a moment ago. But also it says here that as we run the course of God's commandments, He will enlarge our heart. God's instructions give us direction in life. They give us a course, a route, a path to run. In Psalm 19, verse 7, David says that God's law converts the soul. In other words, God's law changes our life. It makes things different. He gives us understanding. And as we run the course of His commands, then He shows us and opens up to us understanding. He's revealing that path that leads to His kingdom. Tomorrow, the runners in the marathon will be following the path laid out for them for their race. According to the results posted on the Dick's Sporting Goods website, last year, 3,573 runners officially finished the Pittsburgh Marathon. Likely more than that ran, but after about 7 hours, they turn off the clock and the rest of them finish without having an official time to note. The winning time last year was 2 hours and 13 minutes. 2 hours and 13 minutes. That's an average of 5 minutes, 6 seconds per mile for 26 miles. Of course, it was won by an Ethiopian man, Faikedu Teferi, something like that. He won't know anyway what I said. But he finished the run in the course in 2 hours, 13 minutes. The top female runner last year was an American named Sydney DeVore. She came in 15th overall, finishing in 2 hours and 32 minutes. 5 minutes and 48 cents. 5 minutes and 48 seconds per mile. Really dogging it there. 74 runners finished in less than 3 hours. 1,080 runners finished in less than 4 hours. Now, to even complete the marathon in 5 hours, you'd need to run the full 26 miles at an average of 11 and a half minutes per mile. Most of us could probably not do a mile in 11 and a half minutes. I certainly don't anymore. Now, the second-to-last place finisher, finishing, what would that be, 3,572nd, was a 71-year-old woman who ran it in a time of 7 hours and 6 minutes and 18 seconds. And coming in 3,753rd, the last place finisher, was a 67-year-old man. 7 hours, 7 minutes, and 19 seconds. Now, according to these official records, last year there were 12,804 participants in the half marathon, finishing 2,853rd. Was Gary Paul Lutz. 2 hours and 9 minutes and 20 seconds. An average of just under 10 minutes per mile. He placed 2,853rd in the overall, but for his age group, he was 65th. The age group is about, what, 110 plus, something like that? So it's good to have a celebrity among us who's on the official record of the marathon for last year. And this year we'll have a whole number of you to keep track of and to note how well you've done. Now, I'm sure that very few people who run the marathon enter the race expecting to win. The goal is to run your personal best, as well as for the personal satisfaction of accomplishing, being a part of such an event. For those of us who don't or can't run a marathon or a half marathon, we still rely on good old walking to get from place to place. I've developed some arthritis issues in my back, so I don't jog much anymore, but I do enjoy walking. Walking is also something that Scripture teaches us some lessons about. Our lifestyle doesn't really include much walking anymore, though. We need a Fitbit to remind us to get up and walk our 10,000 or so steps a day, whatever you have it set for. My Fitbit is set so that it gives me a reminder at 10 minutes before each hour of how many more steps I should walk this hour. And I didn't set it up, but I didn't choose this, but it wants me to walk 250 steps each hour. So it's kind of discouraging when at 10 minutes before the hour, the screen lights up and it says, you have 242 steps to go this hour. That's a little bit demotivating. I think it's supposed to inspire me to get up and walk around, but it makes me want to throw the watch across the room. Walking is not really a part of our lifestyle so much. When we were overseas, we went to the Feast of Tabernacles in Sri Lanka several years ago, and then in South Africa more recently. And you notice in other countries that there's a constant flow of people walking along the side of the road. It's just a large crowd constantly walking, because that's how they get from place to place. They don't have cars for the most part, and they have to walk wherever they go. Now, I've never tried to figure this out, but I guess you could read through the Gospels and try to determine how many times Jesus and the disciples walked between Galilee and Jerusalem. Those two are about 80 miles apart. Galilee to the north, Capernaum to be specific, and then this along the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and then Jerusalem, 80 miles to the south. Jesus and his disciples walked as they traveled through the area. And they covered a lot of territory on foot. From Robinson Township to Canton, Ohio, is 80 miles. Robinson Township just on the west side toward the airport, and then up northwest to Canton, is about the same distance as it would have been from Capernaum to Jerusalem. According to Google Maps, it would take 27 hours to walk that distance. So it's at least a three-day hike to go from Capernaum down to Jerusalem. But that's how Jesus and the disciples traveled. They walked. Didn't have the turnpike and a Subaru Legacy to drive from place to place. I always find it interesting. Look at John chapter 4. I find this kind of a human side, human interest detail that's related here. John chapter 4, verse 3. It says, he left Judea. This is talking about with Jesus. Jesus left Judea and departed again to Galilee. So he was headed back down to the south. Going north, from Judea back up to Galilee. And along the way, he had to pass through Samaria. He came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat down by the well. He walked a lot, but he got tired. These walks, that's a long distance. He's headed off from Judea back up to Galilee, back up probably to Capernaum where he had a home. And He's a man. He's tired. He was weary from his walk. He was tired. He was probably hot and he was thirsty. And of course, he asked this woman who was at the well to draw some water for him. But you know, it just was the life that they lived in that time. Probably would have made his Fitbit explode to get that much that many steps in. But that was just the lifestyle at that time. Very different from what we're used to. But walking is part of, again, a metaphor for the way that we are to behave, the way that we live. Look at Romans chapter 6, verse 4. Romans chapter 6, verse 4. This is a reminder of the way that we talked about how the law changes our life. Romans 6, verse 4, talking about baptism, that we were buried with Christ through baptism, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. After baptism, our walk changes. Of course, leading up to baptism, our walk is changing, but we make that transition, I guess, formally or officially at baptism, and now we have a new life in which we walk. We live differently than before. In his epistles, Paul uses the word walk 31 times. And he expresses most of those times, he's talking about the way that we live, the path of life that we are traveling. Walking, like running, is a metaphor for the way that we live, the way that we're going, and the way that we live that life. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 14. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 14. It's a warning about the way that we walk. A reminder about the importance of how we choose to walk or where we choose to walk. Proverbs 4:14. Do not enter the path of the wicked and do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn away from it and pass on. Where we walk, the direction that we go, the way that we live, takes us someplace. Our goal, of course, is to follow that path to God's kingdom. So we're reminded to stay off those side roads, stay off those exits from the main path that we're on that would take us into someplace dangerous. Pass up those ways and continue on the path that God has opened up to us. Proverbs, drop down to verse 18. It says, the path of the just is like the shining sun. The way that we walk, the journey that we're on, opens up life to us. We saw that again earlier, that it enlarges our heart. It provides for us a direction and a purpose and a sense of where we're going. The path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter unto the perfect day. The way or the path, the walk of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know what makes them stumble. People living in the dark are always tripping over God's law, tripping over the consequences because they couldn't see it. They didn't know it. They didn't choose to live in that way. 1 John 2, verses 3 through 6 tell us to walk as Jesus Christ walked, to walk in his footsteps, to live in a way that follows his example. Jesus Christ observed, of course, the Sabbath, the holy days, God's law. He lived without sin, and he sets for us the perfect standard for the way that we should walk, for the way that we should live. So, walking and running are both basic ways that we move from one place to another. They provide exercise and they represent the way that we live. Let's look at 1 Timothy chapter 4. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. We see here a principle we're going to come back to a couple of times that has to do with making this comparison between walking and running in the way of life that we live. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7 says, reject profane and old wives' fables. Avoid those things that don't make any sense, that are nonsense, that don't provide anything meaningful. But he says, exercise yourself toward godliness. Exercise yourself toward godliness. The word exercise means, of course, to put forth physical effort to train to improve our health or fitness. Exercise is something that we artificially have to do, many of us, because it's not part of our lifestyle otherwise. But we do things that are an intense effort or an increased effort to improve our health or fitness through physical activity. Now, if you want to run a marathon next year, you can go online and find training programs to help you prepare. It'll tell you how many miles to run on how many days a week, and give you other tips and ideas for how to build your strength and stamina so that you'll be prepared at some point to run a marathon or get to whatever level of fitness you're looking for. It's pretty easy to identify those physical ways of exercising. It takes effort, but it's something that can be pretty well defined. But again, he says, exercise yourself toward godliness. What does it mean to exercise toward godliness? What is the training program, the exercise program for training in godliness? How do we build strength and stamina in that sense in our lives? Well, I want to review with you three qualities of character that we both need and that we will develop as we train in godliness. To be trained in godliness, first of all, we must have endurance. We must have endurance. Turn to Matthew chapter 7, verse 13. You see here Jesus' description of the path that we are to follow, and a hint at least at the need for endurance. Matthew 7, verse 13. Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. He's talking about the gate of a city. We go in the gate of the city, and inside that gate there's a path. And the path here is compared to the two different directions that life can take. The path we are on, whether we're running or walking, is at times narrow and difficult. And if we're going to continue on that path, we're going to have the strength of endurance and patience. He calls the route here the way, and again, it's not an easy way to travel. It's not the easiest way to choose. And we must have the strength of endurance in order to continue. The way that's broad and seems easier by comparison only leads to destruction. You're familiar with Proverbs 14, verse 12, where it says that the way that seems right to a man leads to death. The path that seems easier, the path that seems to be less oppressive or difficult or challenging, that gives more immediate rewards, is one that doesn't go to the location, to the place that we want to go. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. We're talking about the need to have endurance. Endurance could also be translated patience. If you want to, you know, look up the word and trace a few other uses of it in Scripture, you could use a concordance to look up either endurance or patience. As far as our use of the words, they pretty much are interchangeable in this case. Patience and endurance are what we need in order to complete our training, but it also is something we gain as we're training. As we continue in this way, we need to have endurance, but we also will grow in endurance through our experiences. Chapter 12, verse 1 of Hebrews, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses," referring to the previous chapter, "let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance." Let us run the race of life, patiently, enduring, continuing with and through those challenges that we find along the way. Now, in a way, this is kind of a circular thing. Because in James 1, verse 3, we're told that the testing of our faith develops patience. When our faith is challenged by circumstances, events, as we're looking and waiting for God to give us direction and help, we have to have patience, and we're learning patience from those that experience. But here in Hebrews, we're told that we need patience to run the race. And so as we run the race, we're building and developing the patience and the endurance and the strength that we need. We read a few minutes ago from Proverbs 18, where it says that we run to God for safety and security. One reason we need the strength of endurance and patience is that even though God gives us security and safety, we don't know where the finish line is for our race. We don't know how long we have to go. So we look to Jesus, as it says here. We run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. We look to Him for the direction, the confidence, the strength that we need, because it's easy for us to be a little bit confused if we don't know exactly how far we're going to have to run. How long is this race? Well, the race technically actually lasts for our lifetime. But that's where it gets tricky. Is Jesus Christ going to return at some point in our lives? Will we finish out our lives? We don't know exactly how our race is going to run. And we each have our race to run. That's what it says here too. Run the race that is set before us. Each of us individually has our circumstances. We have the work, the situation that we deal with. And so as we are running, we look to Jesus Christ for the strength, for the ability to endure, for the patience that we need so that we can continue that run. Jesus finished His race, goes on to describe that in verse 4, about how He looked beyond what He was experiencing to the reward He was going to receive. He finished His race, and now He sits at God's right hand. And we need the strength of endurance and patience in order to continue and to finish our own race. Turn back to Hebrews 6. Hebrews chapter 6. Verse 11. Hebrews 6, verse 11. "And we desire that each of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end." One thing that's challenging to a runner is to maintain the pace. To continue, I suppose part of it too, and I'm kind of assuming this, but you have to find your pace, but then you have to stick with it. You have to continue all the way to the end. Verse 12, "that you do not become sluggish." Being sluggish or lazy would not be something good for a runner, would it? To slow down, to become in any way hindered so that you're not giving the full effort. If we become sluggish or lazy as runners, then we're not going to be able to finish the race as well as we should. If we become sluggish or lazy as Christians, then we're going to be lost in our situation. Distance runners will tell you that at some point in their run, they always hit the wall. That's partly a physical thing, and I suppose partly psychological as well, because of the physical difficulty in completing what's still ahead of them. They feel at some point so tired and so discouraged that they are tempted to just drop out of the race, just to quit. That's enough. I can't take it anymore. But a successful runner, of course, runs through the wall, runs through that moment. And sometimes we hit the wall, don't we? As Christians, there are times when we hit the wall. We become discouraged. We become distracted. We feel sluggish. Not because we're necessarily by nature or character lazy, but we just feel maybe overwhelmed by circumstances that we're dealing with. Our energy and purpose seem to be drained. We hit the wall and we ask ourselves two basic questions. Why and when? Why does God want me to suffer through this? When will God give the relief that I'm praying for? Those are the moments when we need to have endurance. That's when we need to have patience. That's when we need to have faith in Jesus Christ, who has run this race before us. As we continue along this path, as a runner does, as he's training, we become stronger. We become more able to deal with those challenges that are in our lives. But along the way, there's a lot of effort and sometimes even pain to get through those difficult moments. So to be trained in godliness, we have to have endurance, patience. To be trained in godliness, we have to have self-discipline. Second point. We must have self-discipline. A training program for a distance run is not easy. Runners run ultimately because they find satisfaction in it, but it's not always on a day-by-day basis the thing that's easy for them to do. They have to make some very difficult decisions and exercise a lot of self-discipline to stick with the program. There must be any number of reasons why you would not need to go out that day to do your run. And yet, if you have self-discipline, you know that you need to go and continue with that training, even when it's not the choice that you really would rather be able to make. Obviously, the same is true for continuing on the path that God has put us on. It isn't always easy. It takes mental toughness and determination to keep moving forward. It takes a form of strength that is in our mind to overcome those temptations to become sluggish, to sit down and rest for a while and to not want to continue. It'd be nice if it was always a bright, sunny, pleasant day. But it isn't. And there are times when life, like the weather, seems a bit gloomy, a bit wet, a bit cold, a bit uncomfortable. And we make choices. We need to make choices that are sometimes difficult. We need to have the discipline to continue even through those times. Let's go back to Hebrews 12 again. Pull another point here from this passage. Hebrews chapter 12. Let us, it says in the middle of the verse, let us lay aside every weight. Lay aside every weight. That takes discipline. That means making choices. That means relieving ourselves of those things that are hindering us from continuing. Now, sometimes those things we'll want to get rid of, but other times, not so much. The phrase lay aside means to put away. The full definition given in the lexicon is to stop doing what one is accustomed to doing. What we're accustomed to, the habits we have, the choices we've made to become familiar and comfortable patterns, sometimes have to be broken. And that is not an easy thing. That requires a great deal of self-discipline. To set aside those things that ensnare us, goes on to say, lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Ensnares means to control. It traps us, it controls us, and it prevents us from running the race that we need to run. We become distracted or burdened by things that we don't need to carry with us. We're talking about, in this case, a mental or a spiritual thing. We carry burdens of sin, and the result of that sin becomes a very heavy burden that makes it difficult for us to continue. We need to lay those aside. Just a page or two over, James chapter 1, James uses the same phrase. James 1 verse 21. James 1, 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. Lay aside those things that are outside of, that are not part of God's way. This is simply another way of expressing what we just reviewed during the Days of Unleavened Bread. Days of Unleavened Bread teaches us the lesson of setting aside, of laying aside those things that don't belong in the life of a Christian. And so, one thing that we need to be willing to do, to be trained in godliness and to grow in godliness, is to lay those things aside so that we can run this race without the extra burden. 1 Corinthians 9 is, a verse that we think of when we consider this analogy of running and being a Christian. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And here again, Paul emphasizes the need for discipline, for self-discipline. I hid the water from myself. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 27. Paul says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. Actually, I want to go back and read verse 25 first. 1 Corinthians 9, 25. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Everyone who competes in a race, which she's introduced in verse 24, everyone who competes in this race, says, is temperate in all things. To be temperate means to exercise control over desires. Temperate is just another word, again, for self-discipline. To exercise complete control over one's desires. And if we're competing, whether it's in a physical race or in a spiritual race, then we need to be in control. We need to set aside those things that are not going to help us, that would impede our progress. Verse 27 now. Paul says, I discipline my body to bring it into subjection. The phrase translated keep under says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. The King James Version says that I keep my body under subjection. This is a boxing term. If you look it up in a lexicon or a Bible dictionary, the word is a boxing term that literally means to strike the eye or to beat the face black and blue. It's a pretty strong word. It's talking about taking control of and being being able to take control of a situation, and to not let it get the better of you. The same word is used in Luke 18, verse 5, talking about the widow who goes to the man who she's seeking help, and he refuses to give it to her. And finally he gives in. He says he will answer her and give her what she's asking for, quote, lest she weary me. Okay, that's the same thing. It's to be persistent. It's the same word that's used in Luke 18, verse 5. And it means to keep your body or yourself under complete control. And it has the implication of roughing yourself up to get control. So Paul is using some very strong language here to emphasize the importance of discipline in our lives. He says, I discipline my body to bring it under subjection. Not an easy thing to do, not something that we always choose to do, but it's part of the training in godliness, to develop that strength to be able to have the discipline that we need. One final point we'll talk about this morning, the third matter or third way in which we're trained in godliness, is that we must have commitment. We must have commitment. I'm going to make a very profound statement now. You might want to write this down because it's really going to be important to you. He said sarcastically. But here's the point. Again, it's pretty obvious, but it's pretty basic and important. To be a runner, you have to run. To be a runner, you have to run. You can't just want to be a runner. You can't look at somebody else who's running. It's something you have to do yourself. You have to run if you're going to be a runner. The song I'm familiar with, I won't bother you with it much, but I want to just tell you about one of the lines in the song. The song is called Wouldn't It Be Nice? And it's about, the song is about wishing for things, for certain things to be different than they are, so that life would be easier or better. And one line in the song says, wouldn't it be nice to have a couple of beers just to get in shape? There's a training program I can get into. But you can't make progress unless you make the effort. If you want to be a runner, you've got to run. Same thing applies to our training to be godly. If you want to be godly, you've got to be godly. You've got to make the choices that will produce godliness in your life. Again, back to 1 Timothy chapter 4, we pick up another thought here. We've been to this verse, let's go back to it again. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Verse 7. Reject profane old wives' fales and exercise yourself toward godliness. Exercise is a good thing. As he goes on to say, bodily exercise profits a little. Bodily exercise, physical exercise, is a good thing. I do look back my younger years and I wish I'd been more serious about running. And I certainly am not critical at all of anyone who has put in effort and time to become a good, strong distance runner now. I admire that physical effort and the condition that you've achieved. But look at this verse in the New Revised Standard. It shows that there's even something beyond that that's of importance. Train yourself in godliness, for while physical training is of some value, Godliness is valuable in every way, holding the promise for both the present life and the life to come. Just as to be a runner you have to run, to have godliness we have to be godly. The word godliness simply means to live in a way that reflects God's law and mind. We choose to live in a way that reflects who He is. Or simply, to live as God would have us live. We pretty much understand the basics of what God expects of us. There might be some specific questions, but the basics are enough to get us started on our training program. To live as God would have us live. Paul's point here is that physical training is valuable. It's good. It's positive. But it's limited. And it's temporary compared to a godliness training program. Because that training program helps you not only now, but it prepares you for the life to come. It prepares you for eternal life. In order to grow in godliness, we have to have commitment. 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. First Peter chapter 1, verse 13. Therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. That phrase means brace yourself. Mentally brace yourself. Prepare your mind for action. In other words, it means look at this seriously. Face it. Deal with it. Brace yourself for action. Set your mind. The struggles that we have to be committed and to be to have the patience and the endurance that we need to have self-discipline, it's all a mental battle. It's all in the way that we respond to and deal with the circumstances we're faced with. Sometimes, you know, it's a little easier, frankly, to have a physical challenge, something we can face or deal with by running a little more, running a little harder, training a little more diligently. But to prepare ourselves spiritually and mentally and be braced for the battle, for the fight, for the effort, is something that is more difficult and challenging. So, gird up your mind, prepare for action, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts, as in your ignorance. Again, the same principles we've talked about, that being godly, growing in godliness means to live in a godly way. As he says here at the end of verse 16, be holy, for I am holy. Live in a way that reflects who God is. Frankly, as I look back on it, even if I had tried to be more of a distance runner, I may not have had the ability or the strength to do that. I don't know. But here's the point. Godliness training is something we can all do. Being trained in godliness doesn't require us to be young and healthy and strong and athletic. All of us, regardless of our physical condition, can join the battle and choose to be committed to living in a godly way, to be dedicated to God, to live as He would have us live. But it takes a commitment to do that because there are so many other things that come between us and that finish line. So, we're running the race of life. We run the race, we walk the walk. And living in that manner as Christians can be every bit as challenging as training for running a marathon. Let's conclude in probably one of the most familiar passages with this thought in it, 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Remember that in 1 Corinthians 9, Paul mentioned that people compete for a perishable crown. They compete for a medal or a trophy or a ribbon or just to have their name on a website that says they finished in a particular period of time. They have a reward for what they do, but that reward is really what's important to the person who wins it, however that comes about. But again, in contrast to what we're going to gain, it's really pretty trivial. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7, at the end of his life, Paul says, I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. And now there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day. In contrast to the comparatively minimal reward for winning a physical race comes the crown of righteousness given to those who finish this race. We have many family and friends who have finished the race. I mentioned Mrs. Gable just a little earlier. That thought comes up whenever we have a funeral for one of our members, that they finished, they completed the race that they were involved in, and they won the race. As I said, when you enter a marathon, you don't really necessarily expect to win. You just want to do well. You want to finish. You want to maybe do your personal best. But the reward for that is the satisfaction, and it's an important one. It's a valuable one. But this reward is eternal. We miss those who have finished the race, but we know that they would encourage us to continue our race. So to complete the godliness training program, we need endurance, self-discipline, and commitment. We need to be willing to continue to train. We need to be willing to continue to run. We need to not lose our vision or our energy. We have before us the greatest opportunity we could possibly imagine. The race is on, and we're in this race to win. So run for your life.